which are more nuanced and confusing than I expected. One can't carry a gun in amusement parks, hospitals, sporting events, school buses, bars, a polling place, a court, a correctional facility, or within 1,000 feet of a correctional facility designated as a place of execution on a day of execution if proper notice is posted. Private businesses such as supermarkets can ban guns from their premises. Whole Foods has done so, but Kroger has not. One of the surprises is that if you have a handgun in your car and you're drunk, it doesn't matter if you're unlicensed. But if you are licensed, you are liable to be charged with a Class A misdemeanor, which can mean a year in jail and a $4,000 fine. A lot of my students decide not to get the license because of that, our instructor, Michael Cargill, told us. He showed some cautionary real-life videos. A convenience store security camera recorded a customer who happened upon a robbery in progress. The customer frantically pulls out his concealed weapon and plugs the clerk, not the robber. Another video shows a target shooter plunking cans off a log with a rifle. One bullet misfires, and the shooter peeks down the barrel to see what's going on, when suddenly his gimme cap is blown off his head. People do a lot of stupid things with guns, which is one reason I've always been wary of owning one. Much of the law portion of this class was taken up with the consequences of shooting another person, which is what handguns are for, coyotes notwithstanding. It's lawful to pull the trigger if someone has broken into your home or business or vehicle, or to prevent the commission of a serious crime. Like many states, Texas also has a stand your ground provision, which says that a person who is present in a place where he has a right to be also has the right to use deadly force if he reasonably believes it is necessary to protect himself or others. That was the defense in the acquittal of George Zimmerman in Florida after he killed the unarmed black high school student Trayvon Martin in 2012. Your life will change the moment you pull the trigger, Cargill warned us. For one thing, you'll be under arrest while the cops sort out whether or not to charge you, a process that can take several days. And there are personal consequences that are difficult to calculate. One of Cargill's previous students did shoot an intruder in his home, a 17-year-old boy, whose last words were, "Would you call my mother?" After we took a written exam, an ex-cop came into the class to sell us insurance for legal expenses in case we shot anybody. Several people signed up. I did not. Then we drove out to the firing range, an open pit behind the airport surrounded by mesquite trees and pin oaks. There was another class in the range next to us practicing some kind of tactical exercise, which consisted of loping along with a pistol and firing at metal targets, ping, 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 then performing a barrel roll and grabbing a shotgun and blowing away a Bernie Sanders yard sign. That seemed politically off to me. Sanders was far more liberal on gun laws than any of his Democratic opponents in the presidential primary. All of my classmates arrived with their own weapons. I was the only one who had to rent one. Even the middle-aged women in the class brought along their Colts and Berettas and Smith & Wessons. When my turn to shoot came, Cargill handed me a 9mm Glock. I hadn't fired a handgun in 50 years. Since I was in high school. For a while, there was a snub-nosed .38 in our house. It was the gun my uncle used to kill himself. I don't know why my father brought it home. I took it out in the country with some friends, and we tried shooting bottles off a fence post, but it was not made for target practice. After a while, the gun disappeared from the house. I never knew what happened to it. I chatted with some of my fellow students at the firing range, curious as to what had brought them here. The mixed group included an old bearded hippie, an ex-cop, a physical therapist, one woman with a Sig Sauer P226, the kind of pistol that U.S. Navy SEAL teams use, said she just wanted to get out of my comfort zone. There was an Asian man in a button-down shirt who was continually checking his email as he waited to shoot. He said that he had bought his semi-automatic pistol several years ago, but never really used it. "So why'd you buy it?" I asked him. "That was back when Obama was going to take away our guns," he said, as he briefly glanced up from his phone. "I thought I'd better go ahead and get one while I could." Obama termed the notion that he was planning to take away Americans' guns a conspiracy theory. There was one guy I was especially curious about. He was burly and bearded and had tattoos spilling down his right arm. He wore a black t-shirt that said, "Stop terrorism, shoot back." The fear of domestic terrorism is overblown, but it has certainly empowered gun advocates. Innocents like us will continue to be slaughtered in concert halls, sports stadiums, restaurants, and airplanes, Wayne LaPierre, the leader of the National Rifle Association, said shortly after the Paris terror attacks in 2015. But when evil comes knocking on our door, Americans have a power no other people on the planet share. In other words, the Second Amendment. Such fear-mongering has been extremely effective. Whenever there's another mass shooting in Whitman's America, gun sales invariably rise. In the decade between 2005 and 2015, more than 300,000 Americans were killed by guns compared with 94 who died in domestic terror attacks. The man in the Stop Terrorism t-shirt was hanging around with a young couple. It turned out they had all moved down from Chicago together. I asked them what made them choose Texas. The weather, they said unanimously. They told me they had been classmates at Northern Illinois University in 2008, when a graduate student named Stephen Kazmierczak burst into Cole Hall. An oceanography class was underway in the auditorium. Like Whitman, Kazmierczak was toting an armory of weapons, and he had the students trapped. Police later recovered 54 bullet casings and shotgun shells. 21 people were shot, and 6 died, including Kazmierczak, who killed himself before the police arrived. As it happened, the shooter was wearing a black t-shirt that said, "Terrorist." I asked the three of them if the Texas gun laws were one of the reasons they had chosen my state. "Not entirely, but it was a plus," one of them said. I knew from the few times I went hunting as a boy with my dad that I was a good shot. I liked the feel of the gun in my hand and the little kick when it fired, like a horse cocking its head when you give him your heels. We were shooting at a blue silhouette with the bullseye at mid-sternum. I scored 246 out of 250. I began to think about what it would be like to own my own handgun. According to a study published by Injury Prevention, about 35% of Texans own guns, close to the national average. I still have my old Remington 22 from my Boy Scout days on the top shelf in the hall closet, so I guess I'm included in that number. Despite the controversy that rages on this issue now, the incidence of gun ownership in the United States has declined from more than half of all households in 1982 to a little more than a third currently, the lowest it has been in almost 40 years. And yet the United States still has the highest rate of gun ownership in the world, 88.8 guns per 100 residents. And gun purchases are also at historic highs. The statistics are skewed by the fact that gun owners are acquiring significant personal arsenals. My Stop Terrorism Shoot Back informant told me he has 9 guns. That's one more than the average gun owner possesses, according to the Washington Post. Our instructor, Michael Cargill, told us he was carrying 3 concealed weapons while he was teaching class. I couldn't spot any of them. I was at a book club recently in Austin where one of the members recalled being in a restaurant in Houston when President George H.W. Bush and the First Lady entered. The Secret Service set up a metal detector that the other diners had to pass through. "They had a big bowl for people to drop their guns in," the woman recalled, "and there were all these big-haired Houston women pulling pistols out of their purses." I've never seen anything similar in Texas, but the reputation for a high rate of gun possession does affect behavior. In my experience, Texans drive far more courteously than New Yorkers or, my God, Bostonians, where the consequences of being a jerk may not be fatal. Part of me longs to live in a place where people are assumed to be disarmed, like England, which has very few guns and also hardly any snakes. The English don't even have poison ivy. In Texas, it sometimes seems that every living thing can bite or poke or sting or shoot you. You always have to be a little bit on guard. Speaking of snakes, I was down at the Capitol one wintry day and ran into a group of J.C.'s from Sweetwater, a West Texas town famed for its annual rattlesnake roundup. To promote the event, the J.C.'s had brought a dozen rattlers and dumped them out on the chilly outdoor rotunda. The J.C.'s were striding around in Kevlar boots. They would prod the lethargic creatures with hooked poles every once in a while to stir them to life, and the snakes would hiss and rattle and then return to their somnolent state. "They get a little lazy," one of the J.C.'s said disparagingly. A few tourists and staffers ventured out onto the patio, but most people were standing at the windows with their mouths open. The spokesman of the J.C.'s was Rob McCann. "We've been doing the roundup for 58 years," he told me. "They find about 4,000 to 5,000 pounds of snakes a year. One year, they gathered 15,000 pounds, and yet the number of snakes in Sweetwater never seems to diminish." "We hunt the same dens year after year," the first man said. "You want to hold one?" "Not especially." That evening, I called our daughter, Caroline, who was in Chicago, finishing her MFA at the Art Institute. I asked her how she was getting along. She was living near a country and western bar, so she wouldn't feel so far from home, but it wasn't the same. "People here can't dance," she complained. I mentioned that I'd just been to the Capitol and visited the snake handlers. "Oh, I love Texas," she said with a lack of irony that is hard to convey. A good friend of mine, John Burnett, is a reporter for NPR. He and Hawk Mendenhall, the station manager for KUT, our local NPR affiliate, literally embody FM Texas. They have been cycling across the state to raise money for charity. In 2015, they rode from Brownsville, at the very bottom of the horn-shaped tip of the state, to the Red River on the border of Oklahoma, logging 734 miles. That's farther than from Charlotte, North Carolina, to New York. A year later, they pedaled from Sunland Park, New Mexico, just west of El Paso, to Maryville, Louisiana, just across the Sabine River, a total of 1,113 miles over 17 days, mostly on two-lane back roads through the small towns of the state. West Texas was one long stretch of headwinds and road-killed jackrabbits through counties that are larger than some New England states. Once they passed Navasota, the South began. Suddenly, the waitresses began calling us honey and sweetheart. "We saw a lot of Confederate flags," John said. "The state hasn't changed so much as it has become more like Texas, the stereotype, than it's ever been. There are so many more barbecue joints, more gun shops and target ranges, but one thing that hasn't changed is the deep, abiding friendliness." John and Hawk stopped to eat at the J&P Bar and Grill in Comstock, near the Mexican border. "A couple of cowboys walked in," John recalled. He stiffened a bit when he saw them. I could feel the cultural distance immediately. The cowboys still had their spurs on. Their hair was matted in the shape of their hats, and they had the vivid tan lines of men who live outdoors. They were drinking Coors Light and shooting pool, but they obviously took note of John and Hawk, two gray-haired men in garish spandex outfits like aging Spider-Men. One of the cowboys finally demanded to know what they were up to. "We're riding across Texas on our bikes," John said. "Why the hell would you do that?" John explained that they were raising money to buy bicycles and books for schoolchildren in Kenya. The cowboys returned to the pool table, but as John and Hawk were leaving, one of them stuffed two $20 bills in John's pocket. "Give this to them kids in Africa," he said. Friendliness is a sort of mandate in the state. The state motto is friendship. Highway signs enjoin us to drive friendly. And indeed, if you are traveling on a two-lane road and see a vehicle coming from the opposite direction, the protocol is to raise an index finger about an inch off the rim of the steering wheel in a laconic salute. Steve's brother-in-law says he decided to move to Texas when he saw people thanking the bus driver as they disembarked. Texas advertises itself in travel magazines as a whole other country. an echo of its decade of independence as a republic, and it still loves to think of itself as an independent entity. It is certainly big enough to stand alone. Texas is more than 5 times the size of New York State, John Bainbridge marveled in 1961, and bigger than any country in Europe except Russia. I still recall the gloom that settled over Texas in January 1959, when Alaska joined the Union. We had to change the lyrics of our kitschy state song. Texas, our Texas, all hail the mighty state. Texas, our Texas, so wonderful, so great. Largest and grandest, withstanding every test. O empire wide and glorious, you stand supremely blessed. Suddenly, we weren't the largest anymore, we were the boldest. The Republic of Texas was far larger than the present entity, taking in half of New Mexico, portions of Oklahoma, Kansas, Colorado, and southern Wyoming. We have stopped mourning the loss of all those mountains and trout streams, but the imaginative lure of a distant Texan Camelot seems only to get stronger. When we came into the nation in 1845, we were a republic, Rick Perry informed a group of visitors when he was still governor. And one of the deals was, we can leave any time we want, so we're kind of thinking about that again. Every schoolchild learns in the 7th grade, while taking the mandatory Texas history class, that when Texas entered the Union, it came with a prenuptial agreement, the possibility of splitting itself into 5 states with 10 senators anytime it chooses. It does not have the right to secede, however. Texas isn't actually alone in its longing to break free of the federal grip. A 2014 Reuters poll found that nearly a fourth of all Americans would like to see their own state leave the Union, about the same as the number of Texans who feel that way. After the Trump victory, secession fever suddenly jumped to California. We recently learned that a lot of secessionist fever was being fanned by Russian trolls on Facebook. The largest secessionist page, Heart of Texas, was among the Russian propaganda sites that Facebook shut down. It had more followers than the official Texas Democrat and Texas Republican Party Facebook pages combined. And yet, it's a strange, dysfunctional marriage between Texas and the United States. Texas is at once the most super-American of states and the most indigestible. A 2011 MyLife.com poll found that 5 of the 10 most patriotic cities in America, measured by the percentage of the population in the armed forces, veteran spending, community and social service workers, and fireworks popularity on the 4th of July were in Texas. At the same time, there is a defiant sense of apartness and a grudging feeling of being bossed around. When our current governor, Greg Abbott, was the Texas Attorney General, he described his job this way. I go into the office in the morning, I sue Barack Obama, and then I go home. As governor under Trump, with even less to do, he advocates a constitutional convention to consider various amendments that would transfer power from the federal government to the states, which his predecessor Rick Perry once called the lavatories of democracy. A recent law would create the Texas Bullion Depository, the first state-level facility of its kind in the nation, Governor Abbott tweeted when he signed the bill, adding, California may be the golden state, but Texans deserve to keep their gold in state. The depository was seen as a step toward putting Texas on a gold standard if and when we divorce ourselves from the United States. Actually, most of the $1 billion in gold that the state believes belongs in Texas is owned by the University of Texas Investment Management Company, $861 million, which has no interest in taking that out of an HSBC bank vault in New York City. Sanford Levinson, a distinguished law professor at UT, compares Texas to Scotland, another formerly independent nation that has never entirely accepted the loss of its independence. The difference is that Scotland actually can secede if its voters choose to. For Texas, that battle has long since been lost. The only way Texit might work is through a constitutional amendment that would allow American voters to say, just go. Chapter 7. Big D. On July 7, 2016, hundreds of marchers on a hot summer night in Dallas were protesting the police slayings of black men in Minnesota and Louisiana. 2 days before, a video had surfaced that showed two white cops in Baton Rouge shooting Alton Sterling, 37, who was already pinned to the ground when one of the officers cried out, "He's got a gun!" They shot him 6 times. Sterling did have a loaded .38 in his pocket. Another video appeared the next day, streaming on Facebook Live. When the video begins, Philando Castillo, 32, has already been shot. He had been pulled over by police in a suburb of St. Paul for a broken taillight. When he voluntarily disclosed, as required by law, that he had a license to carry a gun, and then reached for his wallet, one of the officers shot him 4 times. Castillo's girlfriend, Diamond Reynolds, narrates the video as Castillo, moaning and covered in blood, slumps against her. "He just shot his arm off," she says of the cop, who is still pointing his weapon at the dying man. "I told him not to reach for it," the officer cries in an agitated voice. "I told him to get his hand open." "You told him to get his ID, sir, his driver's license," she says. Castillo falls silent. "Please don't tell me that my boyfriend went just like that," Reynolds says. Her 4-year-old daughter is in the back seat. "Keep your hands where you are," the cop says huskily. "Yes, I will, sir. I'll keep my hands where they are. Please don't tell me this, Lord. Please, Jesus, don't tell me that he's gone." By now, a number of cops have raced to the scene. They are all holding weapons on Reynolds. They order her to get out of the car and walk backward toward them, then drop to her knees. They take the phone out of her hands and toss it on the ground, but it's still recording, pointed at the sky and the electrical lines overhead as she is handcuffed. "They threw my phone, Facebook," Reynolds says as an ambulance siren sounds in the background. A cop repeatedly screams, "Fuck! Fuck!" The policeman who shot Castillo, Geronimo Yanez, was later acquitted of all charges against him. These two killings shook the country. A movement, Black Lives Matter, had sprung up in 2013 after the acquittal of George Zimmerman, the neighborhood watch captain who killed Trayvon Martin, an unarmed black teenager, in a gated community in central Florida. Other police shootings caused the movement to spread and passions to rise. There were protests against the killings all over the country, but Dallas was an inappropriate target for such a demonstration. In the last few years, under the leadership of its black police chief, David O. Brown, the murder rate was lower than it had been since 1930, and police shootings had dropped sharply, along with complaints about improper use of force. Although the police were undermanned and underpaid, the Dallas department had developed a national reputation for fair and nonviolent action. Indeed, during the march, some officers tweeted photographs of themselves standing with the marchers. One could believe that if there was a way of healing the rift between police and African-American communities, it was to be found in Dallas. More than anyone in the city, perhaps in the country, David Brown understood the pain that both the police and the black community were experiencing. On Father's Day, 2010, a few weeks after he had been sworn in as police chief, his own son, David Brown Jr., shot and killed 2 men, one of them a cop. But perhaps Dallas is destined to shoulder the burden of certain tragedies that mark our path as a country. When the killer, Micah Johnson, opened fire during the Black Lives Matter march, he was only 2 blocks from Dealey Plaza, the site of Kennedy's assassination. The echoes were unnerving. The wounded and slain were taken to Parkland Hospital, where the president had been pronounced dead. Lee Harvey Oswald and Micah Johnson were both military veterans with undistinguished records. Discontented with their inconsequential lives and angry at America, Oswald had turned to Marxism and Johnson to a black separatist movement called the New Black Panther Party, which is headquartered in Dallas. They were opportunists, trying to murder their way into history. Before killing Kennedy, Oswald had taken a shot at General Edwin Walker, a right-wing racist. Johnson had filled his house with bomb-making materials and must have been planning a bloody spectacle. But he hadn't settled on a target. The month before he killed the police officers, Johnson had asked permission from organizers to bring guns to a protest rally against Donald Trump. The last time I'd been in Dallas was in 2013, to give a speech on the 50th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination. Dallas has always had a divided opinion about acknowledging that tragedy. An argument raged for years about whether to tear down the Texas School Book Depository, where Oswald worked and made the fatal shot, or turn it into the museum that it is today. The shame and humiliation that Dallasites of that era felt when Dallas was called the City of Hate still lingered. Even half a century later, there was a reluctance to revisit the tragedy. Indeed, this would be the first official commemoration of the event. Dallas's mayor, Mike Rawlings, saw the 50th anniversary as an opportunity to provide catharsis for a wound that has never entirely healed. Oddly, the symposium was held in a country western nightclub in the old warehouse district. Behind the large stage was a photograph of the president and the first lady in the open convertible on that fateful day. Our handsome lantern-jawed governor, John Connally, and his wife Nellie were in the seat in front of the Kennedys, waving to the friendly crowd. Kennedy had come to Texas in order to heal the political rift between the conservative faction of the Democratic Party in the state, represented by Connally, and the liberal wing, led by Senator Ralph Yarborough. In my speech, I said that I saw Dallas as a city of paradoxes. When two contradictory propositions appear to be equally true, they may contain an inner truth, a mystery that holds opposing realities together in a strange and powerful dynamic. For instance, in 1963, when I was a junior in high school, I was governed by two such unreconcilable convictions. Nothing would ever happen in Dallas, and the world as we knew it would soon come to an end. We were living in the shadow of nuclear annihilation, which infused the overheated religious atmosphere of the city with a giddy sense of apocalypse. The city was experiencing all the usual turbulence of a boomtown, including high rates of suicide, murder, and divorce, along with a right-wing political culture that had run off the rails. And yet, to a 16-year-old virgin, Dallas seemed frozen, unchangeable, and stultifying. Everybody dressed alike and thought alike and voted alike, which added to the sense of cultural paralysis. The only black person I knew was our weekly maid. In such a racially segregated environment, the main dividing line in the white community was between the Methodists, which we were, and the Baptists. I scarcely knew any Episcopalians. The first man I knew to sport a beard, other than Santa Claus, was Stanley Marcus, the city's great merchant, whose decision to grow one caused an uproar. Political violence was already a feature of the city before Kennedy came to town. In November 1960, during the presidential campaign, Lyndon Johnson was making a speech at the Adolphus Hotel downtown. He and Lady Bird were greeted by a group of wealthy white women, later termed the Mink Coat Mob. This was a time in American politics when civility was still a part of public life. So the assault by these enraged women, spitting, cursing, was a shock. Bill Moyers, Johnson's former press secretary, later told me that he actually believed these cosseted society ladies were going to tear him to pieces right there in the lobby of the hotel. The extreme partisanship that would eventually overwhelm American politics was beginning to come of age here in my own city. Then, in October 1963, Adlai Stevenson, at that time the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, appeared in Dallas to speak on United Nations Day. The United Nations was seen as a communist front in Texas. There were billboards and bumper stickers all over the state demanding, "Get the U.S. out of the U.N." Earlier that same year, the state legislature had passed a law criminalizing the display of the United Nations flag. Stevenson had split the Texas Democratic Party when he ran for president in 1952 against Dwight Eisenhower. The main issue in Texas at the time was whether the state's boundary extended from the shore at low tide to 3 marine leagues, about 9 miles, into the Gulf of Mexico, an area called the Tidelands. For 100 years, Texas's claim to the Tidelands was uncontested. Then oil was discovered in the Gulf, and the federal government asserted ownership. Other states had similar claims, but Texas had a stronger case. It had entered the Union as an independent country with its seaward boundary clearly accepted. The Tidelands issue became the greatest conflict between the states and the federal government since the Civil War. Stevenson opposed ceding the Tidelands to Texas, but Eisenhower, who was born in the state, supported the claim of Texas and other coastal states to their submerged lands. He signed a bill to that effect, but the dispute wasn't resolved until 1960, when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in Texas's favor, and the 2,440,650 underwater acres finally belonged to the state, free and clear. So much wealth has come into Texas as a result. Our public schools were built in part by oil leases from the Gulf. In Texas, Stevenson embodied the egg-headed intellectuals of the Eastern establishment. Governor Alan Shivers's wife, Mary Alice, observed of the Democratic candidate, "No man who wears white shoes will ever be elected president of the United States." Governor Shivers then led a faction of Democrats supporting Eisenhower called Shivercrats. It was a foreshadowing of the great political pivot that would turn Texas red. Stanley Marcus had urged Stevenson not to come to Dallas, but he didn't want to appear craven to the daring new frontiersmen of the Kennedy administration. Heckled off the stage, Stevenson left the auditorium, guarded by a cordon of police officers, who pushed through a crowd of 100 protesters. For whatever reason, Stevenson decided to step outside his zone of protection, attempting to reason with a woman, the wife of a prominent insurance executive. She was carrying a sign that read, "If you seek peace, ask Jesus," which he brought down on the ambassador's head, a spectacular expression of the Dallas paradox. 1 month later, on November 22nd, my father was waiting for Kennedy at the Trade Mart, along with other city leaders who were expecting the president for lunch. Meanwhile, Kennedy's motorcade was driving past our church, First United Methodist, at the corner of Ross Avenue and North Harwood Street, where our pastor and staff were standing on the sidewalk. The motorcade turned onto Main Street, where thousands of Dallasites were waving and cheering. It was a lovely fall day. As they entered Dealey Plaza, Nellie Connolly turned and remarked, "You can't say Dallas doesn't love you, Mr. President." They were the last words he heard in life. The Dallas paradox. In my speech, I said that if John F. Kennedy was fated to be murdered somewhere, I was glad it happened in Dallas. Yes, the city was wrongly held responsible for the president's death. Nearly everyone in the country, and certainly everyone in Dallas, immediately believed that Kennedy's killer must have been a right-wing fanatic. How confounding it was to learn that Oswald was a Marxist, this in a city where there were scarcely any Democrats. And yet the city was taken down, humiliated, in a way that few places in our country have ever been, made to take the blame for a tragedy caused by someone who was, if anything, the opposite of the Dallas mentality, the anti-Dallas. But humiliation was exactly what Dallas needed. The city's extreme partisanship, its militarism, isolationism, and America firstness were taking us into a dark place. Dallas was becoming the headquarters of a new kind of corporate fascism, which suppressed democratic checks and balances while bullying its opponents into silence. The Dallas Morning News, the most important paper in the state and one of the leading papers in the country, gave voice to the extremism and justified it. There seemed to be no force strong enough to resist this dangerous trend. As it turned out, though, one terrible deed changed everything. Dallas became more open and tolerant, more progressive, more vigorous, to use a favorite Kennedy word. Dallas is a far better city because Kennedy died there. Now I look out at the country and I wonder if America is turning into Dallas 1963. That would be the greatest paradox of all. The Black Lives Matter march had been assembled overnight. Although the march itself was peaceful, Jeff Hood, a white Baptist minister and co-organizer of the protest, had given voice to sentiments similar to those that Micah Johnson had expressed, calling police the enemy. "Goddamn white America," Hood shouted through a bullhorn. "White America's a fucking lie." The minister later explained, "We were interested in creating a space where anger could be let out." Soon after Hood spoke, the killer began his assault. "Immediately when I heard the shots, I looked up and saw what I believed were two police officers that went down," Hood said. "I grabbed my shirt. I felt like I might have been shot, so I was feeling around. The sergeant standing next to me ran toward the shooting. I ran in the opposite direction. I was concerned about the 700 or 800 people behind me. I was screaming, 'Run, run, active shooter, run, run!'" Chief Brown would note that within the Black Lives Matter march, there were about 20 or 30 people carrying rifles and ammo gear, some wearing gas masks and bulletproof vests. There's no telling how many were carrying concealed weapons. They scattered like everyone else when the shots rang out. Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, the prime mover in the liberalization of Texas gun laws, called those people hypocrites. Imagine what would have happened had they actually started firing. Many of the marchers believed that they were being targeted by the police. That was, after all, the reason they were protesting in the first place. There is raw footage from one of the television stations showing marchers screaming at the police during the siege. No doubt, in the confusion, those armed protesters would have been aiming at the cops. While the Dallas assault was going on, cops had to track down each of the marchers who was openly carrying a weapon to make sure he or she wasn't the shooter. It's amazing that only 5 people were killed, all of them police officers, and 9 other cops injured, along with 2 civilians. Once again, the city was grieving, angry, and on edge. How would the world view Dallas now? At a candlelight vigil a few days after the killings, a detective next to me remarked, "One crazed person doesn't represent the entire community." Although, of course, the lesson of Dallas in 1963 was that a single armed assassin could frame the reputation of a city for decades. "We can choose to let the anger fester inside us," said Senior Corporal Marie St. John, the partner of Michael Smith, one of those killed. "Or we can take our agony and anguish and direct it toward good, toward fostering an environment of hope." Officer Patrick Zamarripa was a Navy veteran who had joined the police department in 2011 after 3 tours in Iraq. His fellow officer Josh Rodriguez recalled that the day his friend died, he had bought a meal for a homeless man who complained that his potato chips had been stolen. Zamarripa had sat with him while he ate and made sure he felt safe. "He wanted to be a hero to everyone," his friend said. The Dallas-Fort Worth area, known as the Metroplex, serves as the corporate headquarters for many of the most important publicly traded companies in the country, including ExxonMobil, one of the most profitable companies in the world. Other giants, Toyota, Liberty Mutual, J.P. Morgan Chase, are joining the flock. Dallas is the hottest market in the country for commercial construction. Even at the height of the oil crash in 2015, Dallas alone added nearly 100,000 jobs. And Dallas likes to spend its wealth. It has more shopping centers per capita than any other city in the country. But if Dallas provides a model for the Trumpian economy, there's a dark side to it as well. Although income inequality in the Metroplex is below that of America's other largest cities, New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago. When measured by neighborhoods, the greater Dallas area is the most unequal big city in America, divided by pockets of concentrated poverty and extreme affluence. One cannot miss the racial division that is at the heart of this disparity. Nationally, on average, black people make up 40% of the homeless population. But in Dallas, according to a census of the homeless in January 2017, that figure is 63%. The morning after the candlelight vigil at Dallas City Hall, Cindy Crane, the director of the Metro Dallas Homeless Alliance, escorted me to a couple of the tent cities under the highway overpasses. There's a lot of pressure to get the homeless out of town, Crane told me as we parked on Coombs Street under the I-45 flyway. A few months earlier, there would have been 300 tents, but the city had ordered the encampment to be closed. When we visited, there were about 120 people remaining. Churches in the area had once provided food and tents, but their congregations had decided that they were contributing to the homeless problem by supporting the lifestyle. Crane was checking to see if the people under the flyway had found another spot to live. All of them had to be gone within a week, and yet the shelters around town were brimming. I only have housing for 4 people, she said. I don't know what the others are going to do. This spot is 90% black, Crane said as she hobbled across the rubble ground. She had recently undergone a hip operation and was walking with a cane, which she mainly used as a pointer. This is the drug section. This is the elderly section, she said. The average resident is an African-American male, about 50 years old, touching the criminal justice system. Many of them are disabled. I could see a few wheelchairs among the battered bikes and shopping carts scattered about. There were piles of trash and empty quart bottles of cheap beer. Traffic rumbled overhead. A woman squatted beside a small wood fire brewing camp coffee next to the railroad track. Everyone I met was from Texas and most from the Dallas area. A man introduced himself as Cowboy, the only white person I saw in this camp. He said he had been here the longest, 4 years. He had a Playboy tattoo on his arm and lived in a kind of fort made of plywood and cardboard. There was a woman named Tammy who wore a sports bra and black slacks. She came from Plano, an affluent community north of Dallas, and she complained of liver problems. I asked her what brought her to this place. I was in the Terrell State Hospital, she said, mentioning a psychiatric facility. She was also in prison. I finally got burned out in Dallas, she said. Harold Dixon is a former high school athlete who has been homeless a long time. He's 60 years old and has a bad knee. I used to work for Toyota in the car wash, he said. That was his last job. Many of the older people among the homeless have never qualified for Social Security benefits because they were incarcerated, either in prison or in mental facilities. Almost all of these people have lived institutional lives, Crane said. Unless they have a family willing to take them in or can find a temporary shelter with space, they have few alternatives to living on the street. Crane dropped me off at City Square, a social services consortium housed in clean utilitarian offices on Malcolm X Boulevard in South Dallas. There were kids playing ball in the yard. The facility offered a food pantry, a health clinic, job training, financial coaching, a literacy center, and a legal advisor. This is a collective impact center, Larry M. James, the director of City Square, told me. Our mission is to help working families survive and move them toward thriving. In the past year, the organization served 55,000 people. In the distance was the city's striking skyline, a beacon of opportunity that seems out of reach for so many. I grew up in a very different Texas, James said as we headed downtown to the Morton H. Meyerson Symphony Center, where President Obama was going to speak. Now, he observed, the things that draw people here are the same things that make people poor. The low tax base entices industry but chokes off social services. The state's refusal to expand Medicaid is an especially galling example, James believes. It is such low-hanging fruit, and it could relieve so much misery. Later, I talked to Congresswoman Eddie Bernice Johnson from Dallas, who expressed her frustration. The city has passed bonds to create what she calls a model program for housing the homeless. But that doesn't take care of the people who don't want to live in shelters, she said. It tells me about the inadequacy of mental health care in Texas. Sometimes I think we're going backwards as a state. We are the leading state in technology. We're the leading state in trade. Certainly Dallas has the lowest unemployment of any big city in the country. Where we're lacking is in mental health care and public education. As I was standing in line to go through security for the president's speech, I ran into Andy Stoker, the pastor of my old church, First United Methodist. The last time I was in that church, I stood in the pulpit and gave a eulogy for my father. For him, First Church had been a spiritual home. He had left a bequest to the church to create a meal service for the homeless. But for me, the church was a source of disillusionment and anger. It was in that very church that another tragedy had taken place that would shake the city of Dallas, a tragedy that also touched my family's life. Walker Raley was one of the great stars of Methodism when he took over the pulpit of First Church in 1980. I was living in Austin by then, but I sometimes saw him preach when I came back to the city. Raley was bald, with a bulbous forehead and intense blue eyes, which scanned his congregation like searchlights. I experienced what so many would later remark on, Raley's gift for seeming to speak directly to me. Dallas, at the time, had more churches per capita than any other city in America. The preachers were compensated like business executives, which allowed them entree into the uppermost social circles. The piety that the city was known for hit another Dallas, however, one that had the highest rate of overall crime and the highest divorce rate in the country. Raley quickly became seen as a progressive leader, championing causes that were often unpopular within such a conservative milieu: gay rights, racial justice, opposition to the death penalty, equal rights for women, issues that brought younger people into the congregation. His social activism was just what Dallas needed. In his very first sermon, he had blown into the microphone on the pulpit, indicating that he was breathing life back into the church. On Easter Sunday, 1987, Raley preached what would be his last sermon in First Church. For the past several weeks, he had been receiving threatening letters, including one that very morning. "Easter is when Christ arose, but you are going down," the message said. Raley approached the pulpit wearing a bulletproof vest under the pastoral stole that his wife Peggy had sewed for him. She was an organist in the church and the mother of their two young children. Uniformed police officers guarded the entryways. The odd topic Raley had chosen to speak on this Easter was drawn from a book titled The Passover Plot, which airs the theory that Jesus faked his crucifixion. 3 days later, Raley came home to find Peggy lying on the floor of the garage, her face blue, her body heaving. She had been strangled. Police would later say that Raley's 3-year-old son had been partially strangled as well. "Wife of anti-racist cleric is attacked," read the headline in the New York Times. Raley was viewed as a martyr for racial justice. It was as if the threats against him and the attempted murder of his wife were attacks on Dallas as well. His friend, Rabbi Sheldon Zimmerman of Temple Emmanuel, who had had lunch with Raley the very day of the attack, said that he had been singled out because of his almost prophetic stance in regard to injustice in any form. Peggy had fallen into a coma. 9 days after the attack, Raley himself was in a coma, having swallowed 3 bottles of antidepressants and tranquilizers. He left behind a suicide note calling himself the lowest of the low and saying that he was besieged by demons. By that time, the police had discovered inconsistencies in his story. They learned that he himself had written the threatening letters he received. They also discovered that he had been having an affair with a psychotherapist who called herself Lucy Papillon. Her family name was actually Goodrich. She was the daughter of the minister of the church when I was growing up. Dr. Robert E. Goodrich, Jr. and his wife, Thelma, were close friends of my parents, and Lucy played the piano in the adult Sunday school class my father had taught for many years. Her brother, Bob, was an All-American split end on my high school team. Raley recovered. He was the only suspect in the case, but the evidence against him was entirely circumstantial, despite his semi-confession. In my interview with him in 1987, I confronted him with the lies he had told, but he evaded, trying to keep the conversation on a theological level, repeatedly turning to my own quarrels with the church, which he had heard about through the grapevine. I was certain he was guilty and told him so. Soon after my interview, Raley went off to California to be with Lucy. Eventually, he began working in another church. In 1993, he was tried for Peggy's attempted murder and acquitted. He did not contest the civil suit filed by Peggy's parents, however, which found him responsible for the attack and which demanded an $18 million judgment. Raley declared bankruptcy, voiding the judgment, but agreed to pay alimony of $337 a month in return for a divorce from Peggy. He married a wealthy widow 2 months later. She also died, reportedly of liver failure, in 2005. The last I heard, Raley had been fired from the homeless ministry in Los Angeles, where he served as the director of fundraising and community relations, after officials learned from a reporter that Lucy was volunteering at the same mission. On the ministry's website, Raley described himself as a global peacemaker involved in monitoring elections in third world countries, freeing hostages in Bolivia, and fighting poverty in Haiti. There's no evidence for any of this. Peggy Raley finally died in 2011, 24 years after the attack, never having regained consciousness. In the security line for the president's speech, I asked Pastor Stoker how the church was doing. "We're still in the healing stage," he told me. "Next Easter will be the 30th anniversary." "Do you feel nervous every time a president comes to Dallas?" I asked Robert Wilonsky, a city columnist for the Dallas Morning News. We were sitting in the press section of the Symphony Hall. Robert rolled his eyes. "My mother was the X-ray technician on duty in Parkland when Kennedy was killed," he said. Wilonsky is a third-generation Dallasite. He harks back to a generation of reporters from another era, the kind who used to be called hard-boiled, but who also carried the emotional weight of the city in their soft hearts. He would have been at home with Studs Terkel or Jimmy Breslin. During the Black Lives Matter shootout, he had been downtown and close enough to the robot bomb that killed the shooter to feel the concussion go through his body. His nerves were still jangled. Below us, the auditorium was filled with blue uniforms. The injured officers who were able to leave the hospital sat together in their bandages and slings. On the stage were an interfaith choir and a police choir. The cops in the choir were visibly exhausted, and some of them kept nodding off, despite the presence on the stage of both Texas senators, John Cornyn and Ted Cruz. Former President George W. Bush and Laura, President Barack Obama and Michelle, Vice President Joe Biden and Jill, Mayor Mike Rawlings, Police Chief David Brown, and James Spiller, the Chief of the Transit Police, which had also lost an officer. "The past few days have been some of the darkest in our city's history," Mayor Rawlings said. "I've searched hard in my soul to discover what mistakes we made. I've asked, why us?" He boldly added, "There's a reason this happened here in this place, this time in American history. This is our chance to lead and to build a new model for a community, for a city, and for our country." After 7 years of near seclusion, George W. got a standing ovation in his adopted hometown when he approached the podium. He looked much older, his hairline receding, his face deeply lined. He still had that way of squinting when he makes a point. "At times it seems like the forces pulling us apart are stronger than the forces binding us together," he said. "Too often we judge other groups by their worst examples while judging ourselves by our best intentions." As he spoke, I wished for the millionth time that he hadn't invaded Iraq. "Another community torn apart," Obama said. "More hearts broken. More questions about what caused and what might prevent another such tragedy. The deepest fault lines of our democracy have suddenly been exposed, perhaps even widened." He was preaching in his familiar, deliberate cadence, making sure every phrase sank in. "Faced with this violence, we wonder if the divides of race in America can ever be bridged. We wonder if an African-American community that feels unfairly targeted by police and police departments that feel unfairly maligned for doing their jobs can ever understand each other's experience. Then he said, "We are not as divided as we seem." Those who use violent rhetoric against the police not only make the jobs of police officers even more dangerous, but they do a disservice to the very cause of justice that they claim to promote. I glanced down to the section below me where Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick was intently watching the president speak. Patrick applauded when Obama praised the police department, but otherwise seemed to study him like the political adversary he is. The division between these two men and what they represent really does seem unbridgeable. The America that Obama evoked in his speech was a community drawn together by common ideals while acknowledging the burdens of segregation and racial hatred. The Texas that Patrick seeks to create is one of exclusion. On his first day in the Texas Senate, he walked out when an imam gave the invocation. He opposed gay marriage, managed to strengthen anti-abortion laws, and crafted the gun laws that make it possible for Texans to carry weapons in public. There are two competing visions of the future, and of the two, Dan Patrick's may be the more enduring one. "Can we do this?" Obama asked near the end of his speech. "I don't know. I confess that sometimes I, too, experience doubt. I've been to too many of these things. I've seen too many families go through this. But then I am reminded of what the Lord tells Ezekiel. 'I will give you a new heart,' the Lord says, 'and put a new spirit in you. I will remove your heart of stone and give you a heart of flesh.'" After the speech, I joined Robert Belonsky for dinner. He brought along his colleague, Dr. Seema Yasmin, whom he introduced as the new Dallas. Seema, a British Muslim of Indian extraction, was teaching public health at the University of Texas at Dallas while also writing for the newspaper. That morning, she had profiled a surgeon at Parkland Hospital, Dr. Brian Williams, who had treated the wounded the night of the shooting. "I want Dallas police also to see me, a black man, and understand that I will support you. I will defend you, and I will care for you," Williams had said. "That doesn't mean that I do not fear you." When the shooting began, Seema's husband, who is black, had offered to drive her downtown. She immediately rejected the idea, fearing that the police would mistake him for an assailant. Everywhere you saw blue ribbons on trees and people embracing cops. There were two police cruisers parked in front of police headquarters, buried under flowers and balloons and children's drawings. It was immensely touching, but transitory. 3 weeks from now, after all the funerals are over, it will all be forgotten and we'll be fucked," Robert said. He asked me, as a former Dallasite who had written a book that was very critical of the city during the era of the Kennedy assassination, what I thought of Dallas now. "I think it is a noble city," I said. "Noble?" he said with an edge of disbelief in his voice. I said that Dallas was a far more tolerant city than the one I grew up in. It's still neurotic, pious, and materialistic, but in part because of the assassination and the humiliation it was made to endure. Dallas has become more open and diverse, more interesting and introspective in a way that it had never been in the past. Dallas has shown it has the ability to transform suffering into social change, I said. Robert was quiet, and I saw him wipe away a tear. It had been an emotional week. When a police officer dies, there's an eerie send-off. As the flag is taken from his coffin and folded into a triangle, a last call comes over the police band. "Foxtrot, 415, are you by the radio?" the dispatcher said, as Patrick Zamarripa was buried in the Dallas-Fort Worth National Cemetery. 531 comes the response. "Please put Foxtrot 415 on a 66. "Received. Foxtrot 415 is 66. All elements, Foxtrot 415. Police officer Patrick Zamarripa, badge 10112 is out of service. End of watch, July 7, 2016. Godspeed, Patrick. Chapter 8. Sausage Makers. When Frederick Law Olmsted passed through Texas in 1853, he became besotted with the majesty of the Texas legislature.